Hey, everybody. As the co-host of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour, it's always delightful to shoot the transatlantic breeze with the UK Midweek Drive team. Together, we aim to provide the best possible audio backdrop for political sanity in the 21st century. This is Phil Lairness, reporting from the middle ground between science and superstition. And you have entered the podcast zone.
Well, that's Richard Fitzwilliam's Christmas gift sorted out, I'm sure. He'll already be purchasing lots of copies at a mere £171 a pop for the official Donald Trump Time in the Office, Our Journey Together. It's released in December. I know, Natasha, you'd be very keen to actually have this, possibly a late wedding day gift, perhaps. As I say, a mere £171 to actually help you celebrate Donald Trump's time in office. And how he actually defines our current leader of 10 Downing Street as the greatest since Churchill. So it's nice to see that that's maintained there. But it gets even more wonderful in so many delightful ways because, I mean, Richard must be torn in so many instances because this week, well, Mew. Where's your baby bottle, Richard? And let's go back to the days of celebrate good times for Meghan, eh?
I watched the interview live, and I really have to say that I think it was deeply silly. It's quite extraordinary the way she seemed so relaxed and happy and the way she was loving it. But what in fact was being shown, I mean, Ellen DeGeneres is someone who's, I mean, she's, I think
it could be degenerating into woke, couldn't it, Richard, if you're not very careful?
Well, I think what it's degenerating into, I mean, this is, of course, we must remember it's the United States. We must remember that, in fact, there is the tremendous popularity of this sort of chat show or whatever, and she often plays pranks with her guests and so on. And there've been 2,500 celebrities interviewed on it. I mean, she's having 19 series, but it's well worth remembering that the show apparently had reportedly an extremely toxic atmosphere. All sorts of accusations were brought up, and it is folding in next year, which was not expected. But having said that, I mean, that Meghan would agree to appear in it, it wouldn't give any sleepless nights to Buckingham Palace. The fact she can do what she likes, she certainly couldn't have done it if she was a royal. But this business of where...
But she is still a royal, Richard. She still uses the term Duchess of Sussex.
No, a senior working royal is what I meant, of course. But the point there is that what will come back, I think, to haunt her is the your imitation of the cat.
Mew.
How about Alex trying eating like a chipmunk?
Well, I was thinking about that, but then I thought I'd actually just go into insulting people that I actually go off on a sort of general tour of, basically, or just where Catty is. I mean, either of those things. I mean, Natasha, how has this gone down in Australia?
To be honest, I think it's not really featured in the news. I certainly haven't seen anything about it. The only thing that did cause a little bit of a stir was the baby photo, the recent, well, not so baby, her that she showed recently of her son. That popped up a little bit, but yeah, we've kind of a lot of other issues going on now. Why she's kind of not in the forefront of news. And to be honest, if she's appearing, if the big news is that she's appearing on Ellen DeGeneres' show, I understand why that wouldn't be big news considering.
It's curious that for somebody who actually wants to actually be private and to step away from that and has made a commitment to actually work with grassroots media, she's really gone for some grassroots media with respect to Oprah Winfrey, Ellen DeGeneres. These are not necessarily grassroots media of the likes of, shall we say, oh, I don't know, the Lincoln School of English and Journalism, for however long that lasts. But there we are.
I mean, I do think there's a lot of hypocrisy. I mean, the way they are so controlling, there's no question that they have a strong fan base, and there are constant reports that she's interested in political career. America's a gerontocracy. She's only 40. She's got plenty of time. The idea that she would have the White House in her sights, will she call herself Meghan Duchess of Sussex? How will the Americans respond to that? Will these sort of interviews, with Oprah having so many inaccuracies and also a very, very cruel, let's be frank, take on the royal family at a time, I know they didn't fix the date when they knew Prince Philip was in hospital, but at 99, obviously it was likely to be serious. And the way they went ahead without any real reference to it, I thought, totally wrong. And the inaccuracies, their truth, will this, if she does run politically, this could come back to haunt her. So,
Richard, don't worry. The Duchess of Sussex could only be stopped from running for the US president under her royal title by a 211-year-old constitutional amendment proposed to stop Napoleon's nephew from ever seeking power.
I've seen that report. I mean, to what extent that in reality works as part of the Constitution, I simply don't know. But the facts simply are that it seems to me all very improbable. But I do think, as an activist, and to be fair, she certainly plugged the paid parental leave issue, which I totally agree with. I mean, there is no question she is ultra ambitious and ruthless. We will await what happens next, but I hope this interview had no dignity at all. There was no harm in a few family reminiscences. She was plugging a book, The Bench, heaven knows that was done. All the audience got a free copy. And they were able to give some amount to charity, to a worthy cause from someone in the audience, all of those. But the strange animal noises and silliness,
look, those of us who remember It's a Royal Knockout will appreciate it's just a lark, isn't it? It's the end of the Republic. It's the end of the monarchy and the beginning of the Republic of Boris Johnson, but it's just a lark.
I wonder whether, what it reminded me of was George Galloway and the milk.
Yeah, mind you, he did a much better impression of a cat. He went... Whereas Mew, Mew, Mew wasn't quite in the same sort of style, I have to say, but never mind.
Alex, you need to go into voice acting. Why aren't we seeing on our big screens?
Well, speaking of big screens, as Richard isn't going to go anywhere near Eternals, before we go into Mothering Sunday, Natasha, as you actually went out in that interregnum between lockdowns, fourth wave was already starting in Europe, and indeed, certainly if you're in Holland or the Netherlands or indeed Austria or Germany, you'll know storm clouds are gathering. What did you make of Marvel's least successful movie so far?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting one for me. So I went into this very blind. I deliberately didn't see any trailers beforehand. And I did that because I wanted to be surprised with the story. My husband knows about this, but I have no background knowledge at all. So I wanted to go into this and see what happened. And we got to the first screen, and it started off with 5000 BC, and I was thinking, oh my goodness, am I going to have to just sit through them passing through the time period for the whole movie? But thankfully, it seems to be done in a much more succinct and better handling. I did like the handling of how they handled the transition of time. I thought that was handled very well. I really like the visuals in this movie. I think they took a lot of care and they spent a lot of time on making sure that it was very aesthetically beautiful. And the music as well. The music was stunning. I think it deserves all of the criticism that it is getting online? No, I don't believe so. I would score this movie an 8. Because I did enjoy this movie. I liked a lot of the interactions between a lot of the characters. I thought that it was quite fun. As I said, the visuals were very beautiful. Yes, there were some plot points for me. Yes, there was some wasted writing and some wasted characters. A lot of my issue around the movie also comes from Richard Madden and his portrayal of his character of Icarus. I found it very cold. I know that is how the character is meant to be portrayed, but it felt very standoffish to me as an audience member. I felt very almost affronted by his portrayal of the character. It really put me off. But I thought that a lot of the cast members, Gemma Chan, Angelina Jolie, I thought that they played their characters very well. Could it have been done better? Maybe if there had been maybe like a pre-TV series where we got some of the background maybe in more detail, I think that would have helped it, because trying to cram backstories for so many characters into this movie. Yes, this movie is a long movie. I mean, it's over 2.5 hours, but it still felt like it was lacking the time and the attention that it needed. So yeah, having either like a little bit of a prequel TV or having something afterwards that it could have catered to some of the time, the flashbacks, that might have helped it. But no, I don't believe that it is the car crash that the internet is making it out. My partner would even go to an 8.5. He really liked this movie. He had a really enjoyable time. So I would say, with an open mind, yes, please read the reviews if that's what you like to do beforehand. But I would go with an open mind. I would definitely say see it on the big screen, because I think it really benefits from having the visuals there and the music and the atmosphere. I think
that's assuming help. You're in a country that isn't in lockdown, of course.
In a country, of course. Of course, within restrictions, if you're obviously, unfortunately, as I was recently in lockdown, then yes, I hope you can see it by whatever means you can see it. But yeah, I think it would benefit from being on a big screen, just because the visuals and all of the music would come together much better for you. And you might be able to see it more enjoyably than maybe just on a small screen.
Directed by Chloe Zhao, of course, Academy Award winner for Nomadland. And that proves that actually we've found the only two people who actually liked it, yourself and Robin Pierce. There we are. Moving on, we go on to Chloe Zhao, but not Paris either. We'll see if we can squeeze in more Paris stuff. But I think Richard Mothering Sunday is calling us in terms of a review that needs to be covered by your good self, really.
Yes, it was one of the galas at the London Film Festival, but I picked it up in the cinema very recently. Now, it's very much a mood piece. I think that the pace of this movie will probably have an adverse effect on quite a few viewers. But it is nonetheless rather fascinating. We've got another movie which plays with time, because there are three different periods, and there's a lot of skipping between them, especially the first period, which is set in the 1920s. We meet the Nivens. They're an upper-class family. Colin Firth plays Mr. Niven. I have to say that in The Secret Garden, he also played an aristocrat who was decaying, as you could say, and Olivia Colman plays his wife, absolutely unforgettably, I have to say. They lost both their sons during the First World War, and this has shaped their lives, you could say destroyed their lives. It's not a question of the old order passing in this movie. I would say the old order was already dead, because there's no life in the class they represent, not as we see it. They have servants and so forth. It's set on what is called Mothering Sunday, where apparently servants were allowed to go home to spend time with their mothers. Only their servant, Jane, played by Odessa Young, a very striking performance, she has a completely different plan. She is having an affair, a very unusual affair, certainly begun unusually, with her lover, Paul Sheringham, at the Sheringham estate. And it just so happens that the Nivens are spending the day at Henley, the picnic with butlers and the like, the Sheringhams, because Paul is the only surviving son of the Sheringhams and the Nivens, so to speak. They both treat him as though he was, so to speak, an extended family, and he's due to marry a woman in his own social circle, Emma. She is also at the picnic, and they're waiting for him to turn up. He is with Jane, and they have a passionate relationship, and he leaves her in the house, and she wanders around it nude, seeing how he lives. Now, this movie, I have to be careful of spoilers as we move we move to another period where, in fact, Jane is working in a bookshop and meets Donald, played by Sophie Dorisu. He's an author. They become close. What happens to that relationship? And what indeed happens with Benda Jackson, who is playing Jane in old age, because this is spanning quite a period of time since she is, I think it's in her 80s. It is a very interesting film, the way it plays with music, the visuals. It's a very languid film in the scene set in the 1920s. The pace will, it counts against it, I think, for some people, the use of music, and most particularly the visuals, but also so much nudity, more nudity than I've seen in any film for a long time. One of the reasons for that, I'm tempted to quip, is that Joss O'Connor is in it playing Paul. What?
And not Olivia Colman.
Not in this film.
I mean, she's the quintessential Elizabeth II. You know, surely she's got to get her kit off. I mean, it's part of the deal, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly part of Joss O'Connor's ritual sometimes. Because,
shameless sexism. I call it out now.
When I saw him have a shower in Cap Not Tin Roof on stage, I've not forgotten that. But in fact,
you should sue Richard. You should take out legalities. You know, that sort of thing. It can traumatize a young film reviewer.
Perhaps you can. And no doubt young film reviewers who want to see this movie and are attracted by the whole concept of it, when it's looking at identity and it's looking at class and it's looking also at the way careers can develop. I found it rather intriguing. It's certainly beautifully photographed. There's no question about that. I am a little uncertain as to why. I mean, the idea that you walk around someone's very posh home when you're nude, does this show a certain...
Happens all the time in Australia, so I've been told. I mean, Natasha, isn't that the way forward? I'm amazed you actually had your wedding day with clothes on. I was just standard, or maybe that was just sort of added digitally afterwards.
Oh, rude.
I mean, but quite honestly, Alex, really, some of the things you say. What is it supposed to symbolize? Is it supposed to symbolize a passage from one class to some form of embryonic possession by another? It didn't really seem to gel. There was so much of it. And as I say, it covers a period of vast social change. I'm not sure that it does so totally successfully. There are scenes, for example, and I'll never forget this scene. I mean, as I mentioned, the Nivens have lost their two sons, and there is a scene where Jane is, was the servant, of course, helping Olivia Colman to dress, and she says that Jane is an orphan, and she's lucky. She's no one to lose. And the way those words are uttered, talk about a life that has all but ceased in any meaningful sense, and that is a portrayal of it. So I thought overall, I did think it's successful. I'll go to about 7.5, teetering on 8 for this film. It's not entirely successful, but it is certainly unusual. And if you like a period movie, vague echoes here in certain of the scenes of the go-between, and as I've indicated, twists in the story to come. So, yes, rather touching, rather interesting, not entirely successful.
Sounds like The Eternals with more nudity and less characters. But anyway, Natasha, would you be interested in checking out Mothering Sunday?
Yeah, it's interesting hearing what Richard said about it, because I watched the trailer and it looked like a really great film. I was surprised with the 7.5, but then listening to what he said, it's interesting to see where that's coming from. I do very much want to see this movie. The opening line intrigued me, as you said, in the trailer, where it talked about her being lucky, being an orphan, and that Olivia Colman is brilliant and so emotive and so beautiful in everything she does. So I definitely want to see, I think, this movie.
It's directed by Eva Husson, and it is a very interesting film, and it has a very fine cast.
Our very own Georgia, of course, Georgia Scotto Di Rosato, is currently actually doing busy work for her events management module, quite rightly so. So she can't really talk about Georgia O'Keeffe at the Pompidou Centre, or indeed Botticello. Natasha, it's up to you. Do you want Richard to wax lyrical about his time in Paris or to move straight on to the Rebecca Hall-directed Passing?
I'd love to hear what Richard got up to in Paris.
Oh, well, there we are then, Richard.
Well, indeed, and when it comes to Botticelli, I mean, one of the interesting things about this exhibition, it was...
nudity, surely.
There is indeed,
There's a theme approaching here, Richard.
You have the birth of Venus, and there's Venus Pudica in this particular exhibition. But I ought to mention that the two famous Botticelli's, Birth of Venus and Primavera, I mean, they remain in the Uffizi, and those are the ones that most people would probably expect to see. There are also some Botticelli's in the National Gallery, which are very fine. One of the problems with this exhibition, where I have to admit I didn't stay for too long, was that it was absolutely packed. There was no way you could social distance in any form, whereas all the French were wearing masks. It was a little, well, something to note. But the museum, the Giacomo Andre Museum, is wonderful. It's got from Rembrandt to Reynolds and Van Dyck to Titian, it's got a wonderful collection of old masters. There are the most extraordinary artifacts there down the ages. And this is, they have exhibitions. The Botticelli exhibition had some 40 paintings, which included those by artists who influenced him, including Filippino Lippi. And one of the characteristics, I mean, I find it very difficult with religious paintings to remember when I've seen a lot of them. They're gorgeously colored and they are undoubtedly masterpieces of their period. But when it comes to personal appeal, I do find it very difficult to remember a lot of them. I mean, this has the famous portrait of a woman who's supposed to be the Simonetta Vespucci, which is very, very striking. There are portraits in this show. There are also the information that I wasn't aware of, that Botticelli, who has a reputation of painting works that are so gorgeous, was in fact a disciple in some form anyway of Savonarola, who was a ruthless character and who wanted to cleanse Florence from what he regarded as the evils of contemporary life. He ended up in a most unfortunate I think he was either executed or burnt at the stake, but I wasn't aware Botticelli had apparently a certain...
Also in the rumour, Richard, that it was actually one of Meghan Markle's ancestors who actually modelled for La Primavera.
I'll look into that, Alex. It's quite an interesting theory, as a matter of fact. I wasn't aware of it, but there...
You hadn't heard of Botticelli always liking to be inspired by the muse who would go, mew, 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 like muses do?
Botticelli's paintings are undoubtedly remarkable in their period. And yes, I mean, you've got a very interesting collection. You've got also got an absolutely packed exhibition, which isn't quite what I wanted at this time. But it is good to see so much interest. And it's relatively small, but as I say, 40 paintings aren't as small. It is a large number. And yes, you've got the Primavera behind you. I mean, people think of...
I had a few extra spare pounds, Richard, so I thought I'd actually invest. You know, what the hey?
Oh, well, why not? Why not? No. It was a very good exhibition. And the other one, Georgia O'Keeffe, she was at the heart, really, of America's contemporary art movement. And, I mean, as a woman artist, she was a pioneer. It's an exhibition at the Pompidou Center, which I always enjoy going to, of course. And she continued landscape painting. It was a which is an important tradition in American painter art. And she was the first woman really to be recognized. And it's interesting, as an artist of enormous contrasts, because she was married to Alfred Stieglitz, the photographer. She was part of the New York avant-garde. And then she broke away from that and lived in Mexico. And the exhibition shows the different faces, so to speak, of O'Keeffe, and an extraordinary mix of work, because you've got her New York cityscapes, you've got her floral works, very controversial here, because I certainly would have gone along with the critics who saw erotic meanings in these works, which she strongly denied and disputed. You've also got the influence of the indigenous tribes around her home in Mexico, and you've got desert scenes, and also, and I saw some of these in the Via Corso in Rome. I remember the last exhibition I saw of hers, where you've got these skulls, and where you've got, I mean, there are those who've seen apocalyptic visions of the war in some of her works, which is perhaps reading rather much into them, but it does show, and she's stressed this, that life continues despite destruction, and there's no doubt that the part of her life spent in or living in the desert and choosing that sort of existence was quite extraordinary.
Sounds as though she's ideal subject matter for the next Rebecca Hall movie, but that's another by the by. I think we just about squeeze in to the whole notion passing, unless of course, Richard, you'd like to celebrate the fact that British television has renewed its love affair with Benny Hill, and on a night by night basis you can actually watch episodes of the Benny Hill Show from times past.
Letters Passing is a very precious film, and we must do it justice. It's set in 1920s New York, and this is Rebecca Hall. It's also based on an ancestor who was a person of color but who passed for white, and it's evocatively filmed in black and white. And I mean, from the very, very first, we meet Irene, who played by Tessa Thompson, a wonderful performance, and she's chic, she's gorgeous, she is also, this is,
she was a Valkyrie in Thunderbolt in Thor.
And she is very, very nervous because despite what she's wearing and the fact she's been shopping, she knows she's a person of colour, and she's goes into a white hotel or a hotel for whites only. And there, this is what happens. She, just to paint the picture, she lives in Harlem. She's married to a doctor, Brian, who is very comfortably off. They have a servant. She has two children, and she's happy. And apart from some welfare work, she keeps clear of the obviously toxic racial politics. So she runs across in the hotel lounge Claire Bellew, played by Ruth Negger, who was a childhood friend and who passes as white. She had two white aunts, and in fact she's married to a wealthy white man from Chicago. So when she goes back to Claire's hotel room and meets John, played by John Skarsgård, she discovers that he has a particular hatred of persons of color. Obviously, he doesn't know who he's married. Now, this raises all sorts of questions of identity. And despite the warnings of her husband, Brian, Irene starts befriending Claire because she starts to feel sorry for her. But what she doesn't realize is that her life, which is well ordered, is going to be turned upside down, because firstly she sees Claire getting on extremely well with her husband Brian, and Claire also loves joining them in jazz white tie evenings. There are a few whites there who socialize with persons of color at that time, and the two women are opposites. So could they share some form of hidden bond? What is the relationship between Claire and persons of colour that she meets?
And perhaps even more shockingly, Richard, all of this is taking place in a time where Ellen DeGeneres' programme is not on air, so she can't go on air to talk about it.
Well, I have to say that the way this is developed, and also the way it affects her marriage, and we have hints that Claire is thinking of doing something dramatic or something violent. The way this develops is into a fascinating movie in monochrome. You can feel the heat of New York City in some of the scenes, and you also have a very, very different form of the heat. The drama builds up. Tessa Thompson's absolutely superb. She combines the fashionable, the affectionate, the gentle side, the elegant side, with the fact that she's going to come face to face with the climax of this film is extraordinary. And into her world comes someone calculating who loves living dangerously. And Claire Ruthenegger's remarkable performance there, exceptionally good. It's a visual and emotional tour de force. And it's perfectly cast. And again, it's a movie about identity. It's also a movie, obviously, the evils of racism are examined, but through nuance, in a subtle way, through the way they affect or might well affect an individual, not as so often is the case when you've got an obvious evil, you often have caricatured characters. Here you believe totally in the people and you get sucked into an environment that is ultimately, of course, pretty toxic and destructive when you consider what's at stake and the fact that John has married a person of color, being completely unaware of this. She's living a lie. When you live a lie, it's only a certain amount of time elapses when there are pressures before things fall apart.
And Rebecca Hall, indeed, her grandfather was African-American and apparently passed white for most of his life, according to Rebecca Hall, of course, daughter of the late Sir Peter Hall. So, Natasha, is this one for you?
10 out of 10, Natasha, by the way, I'd say.
This has presented me with a massive conundrum because I went into this conversation tonight having watched both the trailers and thinking, oh my goodness, Mother and Sunday looks amazing. And then I watched a trailer for Passing and I was like, it looked okay, but there's nothing really grabbing me here. And now I'm just listening to Rich. It's like completely done a 180 in my head. And I'm like, I need to see this film. This is so intriguing and there's so much drama. Yeah, goodness me, this poor woman, I need to find out what happens to her, and I'm pretty sure it's not going to be happy, so yeah.
Well, I have to say, Natasha, that I ought to have mentioned that the phrase passing, which I didn't know, actually refers to the way that that African-Americans of light skin color were perceived as white. It is extraordinary. You will get shaken by it. I was.
I imagine.
Just as shaken as watching the Ellen DeGeneres show with, of course, another person who many would say is also playing identity politics in her own way. But that's by the by. Natasha Wanton, or is it Armstrong Wanton now? I don't know.
No, it's Natasha Wanton.
There we go. It's Natasha Wanton. There you are. Delighted to welcome you for your first official show because your previous shows were all as a different person entirely. What the heck? You spent most of your life passing as Natasha Armstrong. Now you're Natasha Wanton. It's all part and parcel of the Rich Tapestry. Richard Fitzwilliams, thank you. Keep watching the movies. That pretty much wraps up this particular sequence. Any thoughts as to next week, Richard?
Yes, we will have Tick, Tick, Boom as one of the films, and I hope The Power of the Dog.
Yeah, and for those people who actually like to watch their Marvel movies on the small screen or indeed the laptop, etc., don't forget Hawkeye starts a new series on Disney Plus, and you've also got the upcoming Spider-Man Far From Home for the big screen, all to go through. Take care and keep watching the movies.
Bye, Natasha. Lovely to see you.
Make a wish. Well, we always like to have that important factor because it's the power of a wish, etc. It can also do a whole range of wonderful things, especially when we're talking about the Make-A-Wish UK Foundation. And we're delighted to welcome to the programme now the Make-A-Wish UK Chief Executive Officer, the fabulous Jason Suckley. How are you, Jason?
I'm good, thanks, Alex. How are you?
Excellent. And so delighted to actually feature this whole side of things, because on a very serious note, the Make-A-Wish UK charity is about to launch a new campaign called Light Up the Darkness, which is designed to help tens of thousands of children who are living with critical illnesses across the UK. So, Jason, share with us about this particular very praiseworthy venture.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So just to briefly say, so we grant the wishes of critical illnesses, children with a critical illness for across the UK, and when we do, we know that it can bring light to the most challenging times that you could possibly imagine for a child and their family. And there are around 60,000 children living with such a critical illness in the UK today. And we simply don't have the resources to reach every one of those children. So this campaign is about really shining a light on all those children that we're not currently reaching. The impact of a diagnosis of this kind on a child and their family is huge. But we know that in the face of that, wishes can generate memories, for instance, that can sustain children and families through incredibly challenging times. But if we're not reaching those children, we obviously they're deprived of that opportunity.
Of course. Again, looking at some of the sort of findings here, I mean, you mentioned more than 60,000 children diagnosed with a critical condition, which is doubtless going to change their lives and the lives of their families forever. I mean, that resonance will continue onwards. But it's really important in terms of just from the perspective of indeed how people can connect with that organisations like Make-A-Wish is actually developing it. Although you do need a lot of help to do this and make it successful, Jason.
We do, we'll talk a bit about how listeners can help with that. But just before that, if I can just give you I think that it's the individual stories really that really bring home what we mean by the power of a wish. I can just tell you about a family I met recently, their little boy was recovering from a brain tumor operation, and I was talking to his grandmother who was on the wish with him. And they just spent a couple of days together, sort of reconnecting really in the face of all the trauma that they'd been facing. She told me a bit about the struggles that her daughter had faced, in managing his condition, and the difference that the wish had made to them as a family. She said that she'd stayed up late the night before, and her daughter had turned to her and said, "There is still magic in this world, isn't there, Mum?" And that's what I mean by the power of shared memory. Memories are important, I believe, to all of us, but they're particularly important when you don't know how much longer you've got with a loved one. So that's why it's just incredibly important that we've got the resources that we need to reach every child, as opposed to this child or that child.
Make-A-Wish UK is obviously part of a global movement. It was established in the United Kingdom in 1986, so it's well into its fourth decade, basically, fifth decade, really, or fourth decade, certainly. And as you say, you're creating magical, memorable issues that restore the childhood, or at least restore part of the childhood that critical illness often takes away. Yeah. We know why it's important, but how can people actually actively get involved with this, Jason, and indeed support Make-A-Wish UK?
So we are 100%. Reliant upon fundraising, and everyone has a role to play or can play a role in bringing light to the life of a child facing a critical illness. And the best way that listeners can get involved is to go to our website, which is makeawish.org.uk, and make a donation, as well as looking around the site, because there's lots of resources on the site that supports listeners getting involved in a variety of different ways in terms of things that are going on in their local community, volunteering opportunities, as well as donating. It's a wonderful charity to be involved with. And I would recommend that your listeners have a look around and see how they could support.
Jason, would you like to just share with us how you actually sort of followed this particular path? Because clearly, we're in the midst of all sorts of fundraising. I mean, there's the annual Children in Need approach. I mean, this is children very much in need in terms of Make-A-Wish UK and so on. What kind of led you to sort of take up the mantle for this particular charity?
I started working for Make-A-Wish just over 6 years ago because I from the outside in, I believed in what it did. It looked like a people like Make-A-Wish. It's only when I really got to know what Wishes did that I realised that this is more than just a nice to have charity. This is more than just a charity that can tell good stories. This is a charity that genuinely changes lives. And it's changed my life because, you know, to have the opportunity to be part of these sorts of experiences is actually incredibly uplifting and incredibly happy to be able to see this in the midst of all the challenges that these families face. It gives you a lot of faith actually in humanity to be able to come through things. But people need support. People can't do these things on their own. So it's been a joyful time for me. It's not a job, and nobody associated with Make-A-Wish would regard it as a job, but it's more of a privilege, really.
Yeah, that's not so much a job, more a vocation is the way to consider it. Make-A-Wish.org.uk, again, a reminder, that's the website to go to find out further details about this, including, as I say, presumably accessing reports about the charity and the excellent work that you actually do. What would your wish be as the Chief Executive Officer of Make-A-Wish, if we could actually, you know, the universe could actually grant that petition, wish at this particular stage, Jason, what would it be?
Well, I like to sing, which is not to say that people like to hear me sing, which is a completely different thing, but I'd like to play the role of Tony in West Side Story. Unfortunately, at the age I'm at, it would be more likely to be Tony's granddad. As it's my wish, anything's possible.
Precisely, I was going to say. I mean, that's more in the kind of worker miracle department. But you know, make a wish would be fine. I think we work on that one. I'm sure it would work on that sort of basis. But who knows what could actually happen? Again, as you said, making dreams come true and certainly ensuring that those happy family memories are at least generated and developed, which is absolutely superb. Jason Suckley, Chief Executive Officer of Make-A-Wish UK, huge thanks. And we wish you, quite literally, pun intended, we wish you all the very best for future events.
Thank you, Alex, and thanks for your time.
100 years since, of course, diabetes was first kind of identified as a challenge and an issue from that point of view. And things have improved, thankfully, since those early days over the last 10 decades, and to actually develop some of the exciting things with respect to how living with diabetes, coping with diabetes, managing diabetes actually is very much a thing of the 21st century. We're delighted to welcome Olympic torchbearer and indeed ace athlete Mel Stevenson-Gray to the programme. How are you, Mel?
Hi, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolute delight, Mel. Now, you were diagnosed with diabetes in 2001, I believe, so a wee while back. What was that initial thought when you were first faced with that? Oh, dear. Right. OK. I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It was incredibly overwhelming, quite scary at the same time, and quite confusing as well, because whilst I'd been ill and had had the four symptoms typically associated with type 1 diagnosis, so toilet, tired, thirsty and thinner, I'd lost 2 stone in weight, I was getting up throughout the night to go to the toilet, drinking a lot as well with the fatigue. And so I knew that I was unwell, but didn't know that that was what the cause was. And then we went to the GP, got rushed to hospital and was diagnosed then. And that's when the feelings of kind of, oh my goodness, what is this condition and what's going on, kind of kick in then. But I think I had a fantastic amount of support, and I think I dealt with it okay, or as well as you can at the time.
Absolutely. Now, obviously, following on from that, over the last 2 decades, lots of improvements have been developed. And this latest thing from Lilly is even more exciting in terms of how it can help us with diabetes.
I think I'm not allowed to answer that question.
That's fine.
So sorry. I'm not allowed to talk about products. I can talk about the video.
Yeah, fine. Let's talk about, again, your involvement with the video and lines with respect to that.
So, yeah, Diabetes UK, JDRF UK, Diabetes Ireland and Lilly have gotten together to create this fantastic video that really gives a real life perspective of what it's like to live with diabetes. So we're real people living with a condition, talking about the highs and the lows of living with it, and what our hope is for the future in terms of advancements in treatment as well.
We talked about, obviously, the condition. We've just had World Diabetes Day from that point of view. Do you feel that the overall prognosis is optimistic, and actually in terms of actually working through cases such as yourself, basically, where, you know, you can clearly use technology to actually help in terms of managing your overall work and day-by-day experiences?
Yes, I think we are fortunate if we've been diagnosed kind of now rather than 100 years ago, as you say, with the discovery of insulin, which really wasn't that long ago, that the technological advancements have made the day-to-day management of diabetes a lot more successful. However, we are still all at huge risk of the long-term complications caused by, you know, the condition of type 1 and type 2 diabetes as well. So that's why we need to continue these advancements into the future, because our ultimate goal is to live long and healthy lives with diabetes, if not to have a cure.
Absolutely. I mean, looking at some of the figures, we see 4.9 million people in the UK living with diabetes. There is, of course, as we said, progress in treatment. What advice would you give to somebody who is suddenly faced, maybe, or has recently been faced with actually sort of being diagnosed as diabetic, etc.? What suggestions would you have for them?
Well, I think my suggestion would be not to let it stop you doing everything that you planned to do before. I wasn't an athlete before I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. I've since become a mum. I apologise. You can hear my little girl in the background. Don't let it stop you. Learn as much as you can about the condition. Go for the diabetes education courses as well. Attend your appointments, because knowledge is power as far as diabetes is concerned. And the more you can get to grips with knowing your condition, then hopefully the better off you'll be.
You can obviously go to lily.co.uk/century to find out further details about the combination of the programme that we're working through. Olympic torchbearing, got to ask you the question. What was it like when you were actually asked to bear the torch?
It was the most sensational experience, and it meant the most because I was nominated by Diabetes UK for services to volunteering. So it was a wonderful opportunity to show people that living with diabetes doesn't have to limit your sporting success or dreams or otherwise. And to carry that torch in front of 20,000 people and to show what people with diabetes can achieve was just a wonderful occasion.
There's certainly, I say, been a lot of classic cases of sportsmen. Danny McGrane, of course, Celtic footballer. Gary Mabbott, of course, another footballer from that point of view. Lots of sort of cases where people have actually worked through from that perspective. Do you feel as though it's important that, as I say, people who are in the public eye, like yourself, etc., do share their own particular stories with us in the media to actually sort of spread the word that actually this is not a death sentence, this is not necessarily the end of life, it's just the change and adjustment in terms of how we're coping with that?
I do, because I've seen the difference that it makes, because I've spoken at no end of conferences, I've met other athletes, and I know what it's like as well to have been in the audience when I've met other people with diabetes who are achieving in sport. And it's just wonderful, because it makes you realise that we're more than just being labelled with a condition, that we can go on to achieve. And regardless of whether you want to successfully kind of go for a walk in the park without your diabetes getting in the way, or you want to go to the Olympics, I think people with diabetes need to know that they can, that it just takes a little bit more preparation and a little bit more hard work sometimes, but that it is achievable.
Mel, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self today. And again, celebrating the advances that are being made when it comes to making progress in terms of treating diabetes. We've got two final questions for you. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
Yes, it's good. Been great, thank you.
That's okay. And of course your child as well, which is always nice. There's a cameo appearance there, which is always good for that point of view. And the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again? Will you come back and connect with us again in the not too distant future?
Absolutely, yes, it would be my pleasure.
Mel Stevenson-Gray, athlete and indeed torchbearer, Olympic torchbearer. They cannot take that away from you, which is all great stuff. Take care, speak soon.
Thank you.
Well, it's a rare case of some good news from the medical profession, given that a new HIV drug has been accepted for use in England and Wales. And to actually put some flesh on the bones of this particular good news topic, we're delighted to welcome from Manchester, effectively, a graduate, of course, from the University of Manchester, where he actually did a master's in virology and so on. We're delighted to welcome, as mentioned, the wonderful Kieran Yates. How are you, Kieran?
I'm very good, thank you.
Excellent. Now, Kieran, you're 25 and you were diagnosed with HIV in December 2017. Just talk us through how you've obviously managed the condition since then and the sort of situation there, and also what impacts this new treatment will actually have on your own particular life.
First of all, I've been extremely fortunate with my medication that I've been on the same treatment regimen for the duration of my time living with HIV, which is about 4 years. So for me, it's been quite straightforward. I've not had any harsh side effects, and to stay on that treatment for so long has had so many benefits in terms of very little hospital appointments and needing to change a treatment regimen either. With this new treatment option, however, being able to then essentially get treatment every 2 months is absolutely incredible, and it's been a lot more accessible for a lot more people, where people are going to benefit where they weren't able to be able to take the treatment on time in the past. So it is absolutely incredible.
I mean, there's certainly, or regrettably, even though obviously the illness has been around for, well, nigh on 4 decades in many ways, there's still a stigma that tends to be associated with it. And you've been particularly brave, what one might say, and actually being prepared to face that head on and actually dealing with the challenges that have emerged, and obviously running a very commendable life accordingly.
Thank you. And it's a challenge that a lot of people do face. And I think because I am such a particularly young person, there are a lot of other young people who do go through the stigma and the discrimination of living with HIV. So I'm quite happy that being growing up in Greater Manchester, where there is a lot of education about HIV and there's a lot of services available to support one another, I've had a very amazing experience, but that isn't the case for everyone around the country.
Sure. Now, let's look in slightly more detail at how this is going to impact on your own particular area, and also how VIIV Healthcare effectively have had this treatment accepted, which basically seems, in the headline news, it reduces the days that treatment is needed from 365 to 6 per year. So a heck of a reduction there in terms of the way you can actually manage the challenge.
It's absolutely outstanding. When you think about the majority of individuals currently, they take treatment every day, whether it be in the morning or the evening. So to be able to then delay that and do that, you know, 6 times a year, 2 month gaps in between, it's absolutely incredible. It's going to get a lot more people being able to get on the treatment and to be able to stay on it as well.
And what do you think the future for HIV management and care will actually be in the light of obviously this wonderful news?
First of all, it's great because you won't need as many checkups. So at the moment, you do have a checkup every 6 months when you're on medication. Now you're going to be able to have your checkups every time you go for that injection. So it's going to be absolutely incredible to get people, especially people who travel, people with these busy, hectic lives, to be able to do that. It's just going to open up their lives a lot more.
So again, just breaking the thing down a little bit more in terms of England and Wales, it means that people who are living with the HIV currently will soon be able to receive the complete long-acting injectable regimen once every 2 months, following an initial phase-in from that point of view. So, I mean, is it a case of you can't wait? Are you just all set and ready to actually go? Is it going to be a countdown? How are you sort of building up for your own switch over to this system?
I think with something like this that will be phased out slowly, it will be going to the people who require it the most. And like I said, I'm very happy with my current treatment, and I would rather that go to people who are the ones who need it, the people who do struggle with adherence to the drugs. However, in the future, if I do get asked and, you know, brought forward and I'm able to enter that, absolutely, it's going to really impact my life in such a positive way.
We mentioned, obviously, you did a master's in virology at the University of Manchester. You've also, for the last 2 years, been a volunteer for the George House Trust as a positive speaker, basically talking about the facts of HIV and so on. Has that obviously brought some reward from your own point of view? Because at least, again, you're slowly but surely you're beginning to address the prejudices and the challenges that are faced when somebody is diagnosed HIV positive.
It has been extremely eye-opening, especially when I go into schools and I talk with people who are so young, you know, people who are 10, 12, and they're learning about HIV and they're learning about what it is to be living with HIV in the modern world. And this is something that you wouldn't even fathom when I was younger growing up, that you'd be able to talk to schools and to see young people really picking up on it.
We've obviously I've been through another sort of challenge health-wise over the global pandemic that's been the case. You feel that has kind of put HIV treatment a little bit on the back burner? I mean, are we getting back to restoring the sort of awareness of this factor, or is it just a case of, well, that's the human race for you? We always like to have a pandemic around the corner.
I think it has definitely introduced more challenges. However, it's getting people to talk, you know, it's getting people to communicate about viruses and how viruses, you know, they don't discriminate. So, for example, with HIV and the stigma in the past surrounding stereotypes, it's been able to, with the whole pandemic, it's been able to open eyes and to realize that, you know, anyone can, for example, you know, obtain HIV. So it's something that a lot more people are starting to read up about and educate themselves.
And for folk who are actually looking for further information about this new treatment, because clearly we haven't been able to actually go into it in any major detail from that point of view, where would you suggest they should actually go?
They can go to the Vive Healthcare website. And of course, if looking at the news outlets as well, finding more information and contact the NHS as well, just to see if they can find a little bit more about what their own treatment regimen is and if this one is appropriate for themselves.
Excellent. And from your own point of view, are you intending to do a PhD after you wrap up the master's? Is that on the cards? I mean, what are you looking to sort of head towards?
That would be incredible, actually, to go into, you know, the research of HIV and potentially look at even better treatment options. Who knows?
Well, as I say, if you can understand something, you come pretty close to actually beginning to appreciate it and indeed look to employ sort of systems to address it as well, which is all great stuff. Kieran, it's been great connecting with your good self today. Keep on keeping on. Stay healthy, stay well, and many thanks indeed.
Thank you for having me.